This is Audible.
Welcome to the Audio Renaissance unabridged presentation of Middlesex, written by Jeffrey Eugenides, produced by Yuri Rozovsky, and read by Christopher Tabori. Book 1, The Silver Spoon. I was born twice. First, as a baby girl, on a remarkably smogless Detroit day in January of 1960, and then again as a teenage boy, in an emergency room near Petoskey, Michigan, in August of 1974. Specialized readers may have come across me in Dr. Peter Luce's study, Gender Identity in 5-alpha-reductase pseudohermaphrodites, published in the Journal of Pediatric Endocrinology in 1975. Or maybe you've seen my photograph in Chapter 16 of the now sadly outdated Genetics and Heredity. That's me on page 578, standing naked beside a height chart with a black box covering my eyes. My birth certificate lists my name as Calliope Helen Stefanides. My most recent driver's license from the Federal Republic of Germany records my first name simply as Cal. I'm a former field hockey goalie, long-standing member of the Save the Manatee Foundation, rare attendant at the Greek Orthodox Liturgy, and for most of my adult life, an employee of the U.S. State Department. Like Tiresias, I was first one thing and then the other. I've been ridiculed by classmates, guinea-pigged by doctors, palpated by specialists, and researched by the March of Dimes. A red-headed girl from Grosse Pointe fell in love with me, not knowing what I was. Her brother liked me, too. An army tank led me into urban battle once. A swimming pool turned me into myth. I've left my body in order to occupy others, and all this happened before I turned 16. But now, at the age of 41, I feel another birth coming on. After decades of neglect, I find myself thinking about departed great aunts and uncles, long-lost grandfathers, unknown fifth cousins, or in the case of an inbred family like mine, all those things in one. And so, before it's too late, I want to get it down for good, this roller coaster ride of a single gene through time. Sing now, O muse of the recessive mutation on my fifth chromosome. Sing how it bloomed 2.5 centuries ago on the slopes of Mount Olympus while the goats bleated and the olives dropped. Sing how it passed down through 9 generations, gathering invisibly within the polluted pool of the Stefanides family. And sing how Providence, in the guise of a massacre, sent the gene flying again. How it blew like a seed across the sea to America, where it drifted through our industrial rains until it fell to earth in the fertile soil of my mother's own Midwestern womb. Sorry if I get a little Homeric at times. That's genetic, too. 3 months before I was born, in the aftermath of one of our elaborate Sunday dinners, my grandmother, Desdemona Stefanides, ordered my brother to get her silkworm box. Chapter 11 had been heading toward the kitchen for a second helping of rice pudding when she blocked his way. At 57, with her short, squat figure and intimidating hairnet, my grandmother was perfectly designed for blocking people's paths. Behind her in the kitchen, the day's large female contingent had congregated, laughing and whispering. Intrigued, Chapter 11 leaned sideways to see what was going on, but Desdemona reached out and firmly pinched his cheek. Having regained his attention, she sketched a rectangle in the air and pointed at the ceiling. Then, through her ill-fitting dentures, she said, "Go for ya, ya, dale mu." Chapter 11 knew what to do. He ran across the hall into the living room. On all fours, he scrambled up the formal staircase to the second floor. He raced past the bedrooms along the upstairs corridor. At the far end was a nearly invisible door, wallpapered over like the entrance to a secret passageway. Chapter 11 located the tiny doorknob level with his head and, using all his strength, pulled it open. Another set of stairs lay behind it. For a long moment, my brother stared hesitantly into the darkness above before climbing, very slowly now, up to the attic where my grandparents lived. In sneakers, he passed beneath the 12 damply newspapered bird cages suspended from the rafters. With a brave face, he immersed himself in the sour odor of the parakeets, and in my grandparents' own particular aroma, a mixture of mothballs and hashish. He negotiated his way past my grandfather's book-piled desk and his collection of Rebetika records. Finally, bumping into the leather ottoman and the circular coffee table made of brass, he found my grandparents' bed, and under it, the silkworm box. Carved from olive wood, a little bigger than a shoebox, it had a tin lid perforated by tiny air holes and inset with the icon of an unrecognizable saint. The saint's face had been rubbed off, but the fingers of his right hand were raised to bless a short, purple, terrifically self-confident-looking mulberry tree. After gazing a while at this vivid botanical presence, Chapter 11 pulled the box from under the bed and opened it. Inside were the two wedding crowns made from rope and coiled like snakes, the two long braids of hair, each tied with a crumbling black ribbon. He poked one of the braids with his index finger. Just then a parakeet squawked, making my brother jump, and he closed the box, tucked it under his arm, and carried it downstairs to Desdemona. She was still waiting in the doorway. Taking the silkworm box out of his hands, she turned back into the kitchen. At this point, Chapter 11 was granted a view of the room, where all the women now fell silent. They moved aside to let Desdemona pass, and there, in the middle of the linoleum, was my mother. Tessie Stefanides was leaning back in a kitchen chair pinned beneath the immense drum-tight globe of her pregnant belly. She had a happy, helpless expression on her face, which was flushed and hot. Desdemona set the silkworm box on the kitchen table and opened the lid. She reached under the wedding crowns and the hair braids to come up with something Chapter 11 hadn't seen. A silver spoon. She tied a piece of string to the spoon's handle. Then, stooping forward, she dangled the spoon over my mother's swollen belly. And by extension, over me. Up until now, Desdemona had had a perfect record, 23 correct guesses. She'd known that Tessie was going to be Tessie. She'd predicted the sex of my brother and of all the babies of her friends at church. The only children whose genders she hadn't divined were her own, because it was bad luck for a mother to plumb the mysteries of her own womb. Fearlessly, however, she plumbed my mother's. After some initial hesitation, the spoon swung north to south, which meant that I was going to be a boy. Splay-legged in the chair, my mother tried to smile. She didn't want a boy. She had one already. In fact, she was so certain I was going to be a girl that she'd picked out only one name for me, Calliope. But when my grandmother shouted in Greek, "A boy!" the cry went around the room and out into the hall and across the hall into the living room where the men were arguing politics, and my mother, hearing it repeated so many times, began to believe it might be true. As soon as the cry reached my father, however, he marched into the kitchen to tell his mother that this time at least, her spoon was wrong. "Then how you know so much?" Desdemona asked him, to which he replied what many Americans of his generation would have. "It's science, Ma." Ever since they had decided to have another child, the diner was doing well and Chapter 11 was long out of diapers, Milton and Tessie had been in agreement that they wanted a daughter. Chapter 11 had just turned 5 years old. He'd recently found a dead bird in the yard, bringing it into the house to show his mother. He liked shooting things, hammering things, smashing things, and wrestling with his father. In such a masculine household, Tessie had begun to feel like the odd woman out and saw herself in 10 years' time imprisoned in a world of hubcaps and hernias. My mother pictured a daughter as a counterinsurgent, a fellow lover of lapdogs, a seconder of proposals to attend the ice capades. In the spring of 1959, when discussions of my fertilization got underway, my mother couldn't foresee that women would soon be burning their brassieres by the thousand. Hers were padded, stiff, fire-retardant. As much as Tessie loved her son, she knew there were certain things she'd be able to share only with a daughter. On his morning drive to work, my father had been seeing visions of an irresistibly sweet, dark-eyed little girl. She sat on the seat beside him, mostly during stoplights, directing questions at his patient, all-knowing ear. "What do you call that thing, Daddy?"
"That? That's the Cadillac Seal."
"What's the Cadillac Seal?"
"Well, a long time ago, there was a French explorer named Cadillac, and he was the one who discovered Detroit, and that seal was his family seal from France."
"What's France?"
"France is a country in Europe."
"What's Europe?"
"It's a continent, which is like a great big piece of land, way, way bigger than a country. But Cadillacs don't come from Europe anymore, Kukla. They come from right here in the good old USA."
The light turned green, and he drove on. But my prototype lingered. She was there at the next light, and the next. So pleasant was her company that my father, a man loaded with initiative, decided to see what he could do to turn his vision into reality. Thus, for some time now, in the living room where the men discussed politics, they'd also been discussing the velocity of sperm. Peter Tatakis, Uncle Pete as we called him, was a leading member of the debating society that formed every week on our black love seats. A lifelong bachelor, he had no family in America and so had become attached to ours. Every Sunday he arrived in his wine-dark Buick, a tall, prune-faced, sad-seeming man with an incongruously vital head of wavy hair. He was not interested in children. A proponent of the great book series, which he had read twice, Uncle Pete was engaged with serious thought and Italian opera. He had a passion in history for Edward Gibbon, and in literature for the journals of Madame de Stael. He liked to quote that witty lady's opinion on the German language, which held that German wasn't good for conversation because you had to wait to the end of the sentence for the verb and so couldn't interrupt. Uncle Pete had wanted to become a doctor, but the catastrophe had ended that dream. In the United States, he put himself through 2 years of chiropractic school and now ran a small office in Birmingham with a human skeleton he was still paying for in installments. In those days, chiropractors had a somewhat dubious reputation. People didn't come to Uncle Pete to free up their kundalini. He cracked necks, straightened spines, and made custom arch supports out of foam rubber. Still, he was the closest thing to a doctor we had in the house on those Sunday afternoons. As a young man, he'd had half his stomach surgically removed, and now after dinner always drank a Pepsi-Cola to help digest his meal. The soft drink had been named for the digestive enzyme pepsin, he sagely told us, and so was suited to the task. It was this kind of knowledge that led my father to trust what Uncle Pete said when it came to the reproductive timetable. His head on a throw pillow, his shoes off, Madame a Butterfly softly playing on my parents' stereo, Uncle Pete explained that under the microscope, sperm carrying male chromosomes had been observed to swim faster than those carrying female chromosomes. This assertion generated immediate merriment among the restaurant owners and fur finishers assembled in our living room. My father, however, adopted the pose of his favorite piece of sculpture, the Thinker, a miniature which sat across the room on the telephone table. Though the topic had been brought up in the open forum atmosphere of those post-prandial Sundays, it was clear that, notwithstanding the impersonal tone of the discussion, the sperm they were talking about was my father's. Uncle Pete made it clear. To have a girl baby, a couple should have sexual congress 24 hours prior to ovulation. That way, the swift male sperm would rush in and die off. The female sperm, sluggish but more reliable, would arrive just as the egg dropped. My father had trouble persuading my mother to go along with the scheme. Tessie Zizmo had been a virgin when she married Milton Stefanides at the age of 22. Their engagement, which coincided with the Second World War, had been a chaste affair. My mother was proud of the way she'd managed to simultaneously kindle and snuff my father's flame, keeping him at a low burn for the duration of a global cataclysm. This hadn't been all that difficult, however, since she was in Detroit and Milton was in Annapolis at the U.S. Naval Academy. For more than a year, Tessie lit candles at the Greek church for her fiancé, while Milton gazed at her photographs pinned over his bunk. He liked to pose Tessie in the manner of the movie magazines, standing sideways, one high heel raised on a step, an expanse of black stocking visible. My mother looked surprisingly pliable in those old snapshots, as though she liked nothing better than to have her man in uniform arrange her against the porches and lampposts of their humble neighborhood. She didn't surrender until after Japan had. Then, from their wedding night onward, according to what my brother told my covered ears, my parents made love regularly and enjoyably. When it came to having children, however, my mother had her own ideas. It was her belief that an embryo could sense the amount of love with which it had been created. For this reason, my father's suggestion didn't sit well with her. "What do you think this is, Milt? The Olympics?" "We were just speaking theoretically," said my father. "What does Uncle Pete know about having babies?" "He read this particular article in Scientific American," Milton said, and to bolster his case, "he's a subscriber."
"Listen, if my back went out, I'd go to Uncle Pete. If I had flat feet like you do, I'd go. But that's it."
"This has all been verified under the microscope. The male sperms are faster."
"I bet they're stupider, too."
"Go on. Malign the male sperms all you want. Feel free. We don't want a male sperm. What we want is a good, old, slow, reliable female sperm."
"Even if it's true, it's still ridiculous. I can't just do it like clockwork, Milt."
"It'll be harder on me than you."
"I don't want to hear it."
"I thought you wanted a daughter."
"I do."
"Well," said my father, "this is how we can get one."
Tessie laughed the suggestion off, but behind her sarcasm was a serious moral reservation. To tamper with something as mysterious and miraculous as the birth of a child was an act of hubris. In the first place, Tessie didn't believe you could do it. Even if you could, she didn't believe you should try. Of course, a narrator in my position, pre-fetal at the time, can't be entirely sure about any of this. I can only explain the scientific mania that overtook my father during that spring of 59 as a symptom of the belief in progress that was infecting everyone back then. Remember, Sputnik had been launched only 2 years earlier. Polio, which had kept my parents quarantined indoors during the summers of their childhood, had been conquered by the Salk vaccine. People had no idea that viruses were cleverer than human beings and thought they'd soon be a thing of the past. In that optimistic post-war America, which I caught the tail end of, everybody was the master of his own destiny, so it only followed that my father would try to be the master of his. A few days after he had broached his plan to Tessie, Milton came home one evening with a present. It was a jewelry box tied with a ribbon. "What's this for?" Tessie asked suspiciously. "What do you mean, what's it for?" "It's not my birthday. It's not our anniversary, so why are you giving me a present?"
"Do I have to have a reason to give you a present?
Go on, open it."
Tessie crumpled up one corner of her mouth unconvinced, but it was difficult to hold a jewelry box in your hand without opening it, so finally she slipped off the ribbon and snapped the box open. Inside, on black velvet, was a thermometer.
"A thermometer," said my mother.
"That's not just any thermometer," said Milton. "I had to go to 3 different pharmacies to find one of these."
"A luxury model, huh?"
"That's right," said Milton. "That's what you call a basal thermometer. It reads the temperature down to 1/10 of a degree." He raised his eyebrows. "Normal thermometers only read every 2/10. This one does it every 1/10. Try it out. Put it in your mouth."
"I don't have a fever," said Tessie.
"This isn't about a fever. You use it to find out what your base temperature is. It's more accurate and precise than a regular fever-type thermometer."
"Next time, bring me a necklace."
But Milton persisted. "Your body temperature's changing all the time, Tess. You may not notice, but it is. You're in constant flux temperature-wise. Say, for instance..."
A little cough.
"You happen to be ovulating. Then your temperature goes up 6/10 of a degree in most case scenarios." "Now," my father went on, gaining steam, not noticing that his wife was frowning, "if we were to implement the system we talked about the other day, just for instance, say, what you do is first establish your base temperature. It might not be 98.6. Everybody's a little different. That's another thing I learned from Uncle Pete. Anyway, once you establish your base temperature, then you'd look for that 6/10 degree rise. And that's when, if we were to go through with this,
That's when we'd know to, you know, mix the cocktail.
My mother said nothing. She only put the thermometer into the box, closed it, and handed it back to her husband.
Okay, he said. Fine, suit yourself. We may get another boy, number two. That's the way you want it. That's the way it'll be.
I'm not so sure we're going to have anything at the moment, replied my mother. Meanwhile, in the green room to the world, I waited. Not even a gleam in my father's eye yet. He was staring gloomily at the thermometer case in his lap. Now my mother gets up from the so-called love seat. She heads for the stairway, holding a hand to her forehead, and the likelihood of my ever coming to be seems more and more remote. Now my father gets up to make his rounds, turning out lights, locking doors. As he climbs the stairway, there's hope for me again. The timing of the thing had to be just so in order for me to become the person I am. Delay the act by an hour and you change the gene selection. My conception was still weeks away, but already my parents had begun their slow collision into each other. In our upstairs hallway, the Acropolis nightlight is burning, a gift from Jackie Hallis, who owns a souvenir shop. My mother is at her vanity when my father enters the bedroom. With two fingers, she rubs Noxzema into her face, wiping it off with a tissue. My father had only to say an affectionate word, and she would have forgiven him. Not me, but somebody like me might have been made that night. An infinite number of possible selves crowded the threshold, me among them, but with no guaranteed ticket. The hours moving slowly, the planets in the heavens circling at their usual pace, weather coming into it too, because my mother was afraid of thunderstorms and would have cuddled against my father had it rained that night. But no, clear skies held out, as did my parents' stubbornness. The bedroom light went out. They stayed on their own sides of the bed. At last from my mother, night, and from my father, see you in the morning. The moments that led up to me fell into place as though decreed, which I guess is why I think about them so much. The following Sunday, my mother took Desdemona and my brother to church. My father never went along, having become an apostate at the age of 8 over the exorbitant price of votive candles. Likewise, my grandfather preferred to spend his mornings working on a modern Greek translation of the restored poems of Sappho. For the next 7 years, despite repeated strokes, my grandfather worked at a small desk, piecing together the legendary fragments into a larger mosaic, adding a stanza here, a coda there, soldering an anapest or an iamb. In the evenings, he played his bordello music and smoked a hookah pipe. In 1959, Assumption Greek Orthodox Church was located on Charlevoix. It was there that I would be baptized less than a year later and would be brought up in the Orthodox faith. Assumption, with its revolving chief priests, each sent to us via the Patriarchate in Constantinople, each arriving in the full beard of his authority, the embroidered vestments of his sanctity, but each wearying after a time. 6 months was the rule. Because of the squabbling of the congregation, the personal attacks on the way he sang, the constant need to shush the parishioners who treated the church like the bleachers at Tiger Stadium, and finally, the effort of delivering a sermon each week, twice, first in Greek and then again in English. Assumption, with its spirited coffee hours, its bad foundation and roof leaks, its strenuous ethnic festivals, its catechism classes, where our heritage was briefly kept alive in us before being allowed to die in the great diaspora. Tessie and company advanced down the central aisle, past the sand-filled trays of votive candles. Above, as big as a float in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade, was the Christ Pantocrator. He curved across the dome like space itself. Unlike the suffering, earthbound Christs depicted at eye level on the church walls, our Christ Pantocrator was clearly transcendent, all-powerful, heaven-bestriding. He was reaching down to the apostles above the altar to present the 4 rolled-up sheepskins of the Gospels. And my mother, who tried all her life to believe in God without ever quite succeeding, looked up at him for guidance. The Christ Trice Pentocrator's eyes flickered in the dim light. They seemed to suck Tessie upward, through the swirling incense. The Savior's eyes glowed like television's flashing scenes of recent events. First, there was Desdemona the week before, giving advice to her daughter-in-law.
"Why do you want more children, Tessie?" she had asked with studied nonchalance, bending to look in the oven, hiding the alarm on her face. An alarm that would go unexplained for another 16 years.
Desdemona waved the idea away.
More children, more trouble.
Next, there was Dr. Philobosian, our elderly family physician. With ancient diplomas behind him, the old doctor gave his verdict.
Nonsense. Male sperm swim faster. Listen, the first person who saw sperm under a microscope was Lee Von Hawk. Do you know what they looked like to him? Like worms.
And then Desdemona was back, taking a different angle.
God decides what baby is, not you.
These scenes ran through my mother's mind during the interminable Sunday service. The congregation stood and sat in the front pew. My cousins, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and Cleopatra fidgeted. Father Mike emerged from behind the icon screen and swung his censer. My mother tried to pray, but it was no use. She barely survived until coffee hour. From the tender age of 12, my mother had been unable to start her day without the aid of at least 2 cups of immoderately strong tar-black unsweetened coffee, a taste for which she had picked up from the tugboat captains and zooty bachelors who filled the boarding house where she had grown up. As a high school girl, standing 5'1" tall, she had sat next to auto workers at the corner diner having coffee before her first class. While they scanned the racing forms, Tessie finished her civics homework. Now, in the church basement, she told Chapter 11 to run off and play with the other children while she got a cup of coffee to restore herself. She was on her second cup when a soft, womanly voice sighed in her ear.
"Good morning, Tessie."
It was her brother-in-law, Father Michael Antoniou.
"Hi, Father Mike. Beautiful service today," Tessie said, and immediately regretted it.
Father Mike was the assistant priest at Assumption. When the last priest had left, harangued back to Athens after a mere 3 months, the family had hoped that Father Mike might be promoted. But in the end, another new foreign-born priest, Father Gregorios, had been given the post. Aunt Zoe, who never missed a chance to lament her marriage, had said at dinner in her comedian's voice, "My husband, always the bridesmaid and never the bride." By complimenting the service, Tessie hadn't intended to compliment Father Greg. The situation was made still more delicate by the fact that years ago, Tessie and Michael Antoniou had been engaged to be married. Now she was married to Milton, and Father Mike was married to Milton's sister. Tessie had come down to clear her head and have her coffee, and already the day was getting out of hand. Father Mike didn't appear to notice the slight, however. He stood smiling, his eyes gentle above the roaring waterfall of his beard. A sweet-natured man, Father Mike was popular with church widows. They liked to crowd around him, offering him cookies and bathing in his beatific essence. Part of this essence came from Father Mike's perfect contentment at being only 5'4". His shortness had a charitable aspect to it, as though he had given away his height. He seemed to have forgiven Tessie for breaking off their engagement years ago, but it was always there in the air between them, like the talcum powder that sometimes puffed out of his clerical collar. Smiling, carefully holding his coffee cup and saucer, Father Mike asked,
"So, Tessie, how are things at home?"
My mother knew, of course, that as a weekly Sunday guest at our house, Father Mike was fully informed about the thermometer scheme. Looking in his eyes, she thought she detected a glint of amusement.
"You're coming over to the house today," she said carelessly.
"You can see for yourself."
"I'm looking forward to it," said Father Mike. "We always have such interesting discussions at your house."
Tessie examined Father Mike's eyes again. But now they seemed full of genuine warmth. And then something happened to take her tension away from Father Mike completely. Across the room, Chapter 11 had stood on a chair to reach the tap of the coffee urn. He was trying to fill a coffee cup, but once he got the tap open, he couldn't get it closed. Scalding coffee poured out across the table. The hot liquid splattered a girl who was standing nearby. The girl jumped back, her mouth open, but no sound came out. With great speed, my mother ran across the room and whisked the girl into the ladies' room. No one remembers the girl's name. She didn't belong to any of the regular parishioners. She wasn't even Greek. She appeared at church that one day and never again, and seems to have existed for the sole purpose of changing my mother's mind. In the bathroom, the girl held her steaming shirt away from her body while Tessie brought damp towels.
"Are you okay, honey? Did you get burned?" "He's very clumsy, that boy," the girl said.
"He can be. He gets into everything.
Boys can be very obstreperous."
Tessie smiled. "You have quite a vocabulary." At this compliment, the girl broke into a big smile.
"Obstreperous is my favorite word. My brother is very obstreperous. Last month, my favorite word was turgid, but you can't use turgid that much. Not that many things are turgid when you think about it."
"You're right about that," said Tessie, laughing, "but obstreperous is all over the place."
"I couldn't agree with you more," said the girl.
2 weeks later, Easter Sunday, 1959. Our religion's adherence to the Julian calendar has once again left us out of sync with the neighborhood. 2 Sundays ago, my brother watched as the other kids on the block hunted multicolored eggs in nearby bushes. He saw his friends eating the heads off chocolate bunnies and tossing handfuls of jelly beans into cavity-rich mouths. Standing at the window, my brother wanted more than anything to believe in an American God who got resurrected on the right day. Only yesterday was Chapter 11 finally allowed to dye his own eggs, and then only in one color, red. All over the house, red eggs gleamed in lengthening solstice rays. Red eggs fill bowls on the dining room table. They hang from string pouches over doorways. They crowd the mantel and are baked into loaves of cruciform tzatziki. But now it is late afternoon. Dinner is over, and my brother is smiling, because now comes the one part of Greek Easter he prefers to egg hunts and jelly beans, the egg-cracking game. Everyone gathers around the dining table. Biting his lip, Chapter 11 selects an egg from the bowl, studies it, returns it. He selects another.
"This looks like a good one,"
Milton says, choosing his own egg.
"Built like a Brinks truck."
Milton holds his egg up. Chapter 11 prepares to attack, when suddenly, my mother taps my father on the back.
Just a minute, Tessie. We're cracking eggs here."
She taps him harder.
"What?"
"My temperature." She pauses. "It's up 6 tenths. She has been using the thermometer. This is the first my father has heard of it.
"Now?"
my father whispers.
"Jesus, Tessie, are you sure?"
"No, I'm not sure. You told me to watch for any rise in my temperature, and I'm telling you, I'm up 6 tenths of a degree.
And lowering her voice, "plus, it's been 13 days since my last you-know-what."
"Come on, Dad,"
Chapter 11 pleads.
"Time out," Milton says. He puts his egg in the ashtray. "That's my egg. Nobody touch it until I come back."
Upstairs, in the master bedroom, my parents accomplish the act. A child's natural decorum makes me refrain from imagining the scene in too much detail. Only this. When they're done, as if topping off the tank, my father says,
"I should do it."
Turns out he's right. In May, Tessie learns she's pregnant, and the waiting begins. By 6 weeks, I have eyes and ears. By 7, nostrils, even lips. My genitals begin to form. Fetal hormones, taking chromosomal cues, inhibit Mullerian structures, promote Wolfian ducts. My 23 paired chromosomes have linked up and crossed over, spinning their roulette wheel, as my papu puts his hand on my mother's belly and says,
"Lucky two."
Arrayed in their regiments, my genes carry out their orders. All except two. a pair of miscreants, or revolutionaries, depending on your view, hiding out on chromosome number 5. Together, they siphon off an enzyme which stops the production of a certain hormone, which complicates my life. In the living room, the men have stopped talking about politics and instead lay bets on whether Milt's new kid will be a boy or a girl. My father is confident 24 hours after the deed, my mother's body temperature rose another 2 tenths, confirming ovulation. By then, the male sperm had given up, exhausted. The female sperm, like tortoises, won the race, at which point Tessie handed Milton the thermometer and told him she never wanted to see it again. All this led up to the day Desdemona dangled a utensil over my mother's belly. The sonogram didn't exist at the time. The spoon was the next best thing. Desdemona crouched. The kitchen grew silent. The other women bit their lower lips, watching, waiting. For the first minute, the spoon didn't move at all. Desdemona's hand shook, and after long seconds had passed, Aunt Lena steadied it. The spoon twirled. I kicked. My mother cried out. And then, slowly, moved by a wind no one felt, in that unearthly Ouija-board way, the silver spoon began to move, to swing, at first in a small circle, but each orbit growing gradually more elliptical until the path flattened into a straight line pointing from oven to banquette, north to south, in other words. Desdemona cried, "Koros!" And the room erupted with shouts of, "Koros! Koros!" That night, my father said, 23 in a row means she's bound for a fall. This time she's wrong, trust me. I don't mind if it's a boy, my mother said. I really don't, as long as it's healthy. 10 fingers, 10 toes. What's this it? That's my daughter you're talking about. I was born a week after New Year's on January 8, 1960. In the waiting room, supplied only with pink ribbon cigars, my father cried out, "Bingo!" I was a girl. 19 inches long. 7 pounds, 4 ounces. That same January 8th, my grandfather suffered the first of his 13 strokes. Awakened by my parents rushing off to the hospital, he'd gotten out of bed and gone downstairs to make himself a cup of coffee. An hour later, Desdemona found him lying on the kitchen floor. Though his mental faculties remained intact, that morning, as I let out my first cry at Women's Hospital, my papu lost the ability to speak. According to Desdemona, my grandfather collapsed right after overturning his coffee cup to read his fortune in the grounds. When he heard the news of my sex, Uncle Pete refused to accept any congratulations. There was no magic involved. Besides, he joked, Milt did all the work. Desdemona became grim. Her American-born son had been proven right, and with this fresh defeat, the old country, in which he still tried to live despite its being 4,000 miles and 38 years away, receded one more notch. My arrival marked the end of her baby guessing and the start of her husband's long decline. Though the silkworm box reappeared now and then, the spoon was no longer among its treasures. I was extracted, spanked, and hosed off in that order. They wrapped me in a blanket and put me on display among 6 other infants, 4 boys, 2 girls, all of them, unlike me, correctly tagged. This can't be true, but I remember it. Sparks slowly filling a dark screen. Someone had switched on my eyes. Matchmaking. When this story goes out into the world, I may become the most famous hermaphrodite in history. There have been others before me. Alexina Babin attended a girls' boarding school in France before becoming Abel. She left behind an autobiography, which Michel Foucault discovered in the archives of the French Department of Public Hygiene. Her memoirs, which end shortly before her suicide, make unsatisfactory reading. And it was after finishing them years ago that I first got the idea to write my own. Gottlieb Gottlick, born in 1798, lived as Marie Rosine until the age of 33. One day, abdominal pains sent Marie to the doctor. The physician checked for a hernia and found undescended testicles instead. From then on, Marie donned men's clothes and took the name of Gottlieb and made a fortune traveling around Europe, exhibiting himself to medical men. As far as the doctors are concerned, I'm even better than Gottlieb. To the extent that fetal hormones affect brain chemistry and histology, I've got a male brain, but I was raised a girl. If you were going to devise an experiment to measure the relative influences of nature versus nurture, you couldn't come up with anything better than my life. During my time at the clinic nearly 3 decades ago, Dr. Luce ran me through a barrage of tests. I was given the Benton Visual Retention Test and the Bender Visual Motor Gestalt Test. My verbal IQ was measured, and lots of other things, too. Luce even analyzed my prose style to see if I wrote in a linear, masculine way or in a circular, feminine one. All I know is this. Despite my androgenized brain, there's an innate feminine circularity in the story I have to tell. In any genetic history, I'm the final clause in a periodic sentence. And that sentence begins a long time ago, in another language, and you have to read it from the beginning to get to the end, which is my arrival. And so now, having been born, I'm going to rewind the film so that my pink blanket flies off, my crib scoots across the floor as my umbilical cord reattaches, and I cry out as I'm sucked back between my mother's legs. She gets really fat again, then back some more as a spoon stops swinging and a thermometer goes back into its velvet case. Sputnik chases its rocket trail back to the launching pad and polio stalks the land. There's a quick shot of my father as a 20-year-old clarinetist playing an Artie Shaw number into the phone. And then he's in church, age 8, being scandalized by the price of candles. And next my grandfather is untaping his first U.S. dollar bill over a cash register in 1931. Then we're out of America completely. We're in the middle of the ocean. The soundtrack sounding funny in reverse. A steamship appears, and up on deck, a lifeboat is curiously rocking. But then the boat docks, stern first, and we're up on dry land again, where the film unspools back at the beginning. In the late summer of 1922, my grandmother, Desdemona Stefanides, wasn't predicting births, but deaths, specifically her own. She was in her silkworm cocoonery high on the slope of Mount Olympus in Asia Minor when her heart, without warning, missed a beat. It was a distinct sensation. She felt her heart stop and squeeze into a ball. Then, as she stiffened, it began to race, thumping against her ribs. She let out a small, astonished cry. Her 20,000 silkworms, sensitive to human emotion, stopped spinning cocoons. Squinting in the dim light, my grandmother looked down to see the front of her tunic visibly fluttering. And in that instant, as she recognized the insurrection inside her, Desdemona became what she'd remain for the rest of her life, a sick person imprisoned in a healthy body. Nevertheless, unable to believe in her own endurance, despite her already quieting heart, she stepped out of the cocoonery to take a last look at the world she wouldn't be leaving for another 58 years. The view was impressive. 1,000 feet below lay the old Ottoman capital of Bursa, like a backgammon board spread out across the valley's green felt. Red diamonds of roof tile fit into diamonds of whitewash. Here and there, the Sultan's tombs were stacked up like bright ships. Back in 1922, automobile traffic didn't clog the streets, ski lifts didn't cut swaths into the mountains' pine forests, metallurgic and textile plants didn't ring the city, filling the air with smog. Bursa looked, at least from 1,000 feet up, pretty much as it had for the past 6 centuries. A holy city, necropolis of the Ottomans, and center of the silk trade, its quiet, declining streets abloom with minarets and cypress trees. The tiles of the green mosque had turned blue with age, but that was about it. Desdemona Stefanides, however, kibitzing from afar, gazed down on the board and saw what the players had missed. To psychoanalyze my grandmother's heart palpitations, they were the manifestations of grief. Her parents were dead, killed in the recent war with the Turks. The Greek army, encouraged by the Allied nations, had invaded western Turkey in 1919, reclaiming the ancient Greek territory in Asia Minor. After years of living apart up on the mountain, the people of Vitanios, my grandmother's village, had emerged into the safety of the Megali Ithia, the big idea, the dream of Greater Greece. It was now Greek troops who occupied Bursa. A Greek flag flew over the former Ottoman palace. The Turks and their leader Mustafa Kemal had retreated to Angora in the east. For the first time in their lives, the Greeks of Asia Minor were out from under Turkish rule. No longer were the Giaours, infidel dogs, forbidden to wear bright clothing, or ride horses, or use saddles. Never again, as in the last centuries, would Ottoman officials arrive in the village every year, carting off the strongest boys to serve in the janissaries. Now, when the village men took silk to market in Bursa, they were free Greeks in a free Greek city. Desdemona, however, mourning her parents, was still imprisoned by the past. And so she stood on the mountain, looking down at the emancipated city, and felt cheated by her inability to feel happy like everybody else. Years later, in her widowhood, when she'd spend a decade in bed trying with great vitality to die, she would finally agree that those 2 years between wars, a half century earlier, had been the only decent time in her life. But by then, everyone she'd known would be dead, and she could only tell it to the television. For the greater part of an hour, Desdemona had been trying to ignore her foreboding by working in the cocoonery. She'd come out the back door of the house through the sweet-smelling grape arbor and across the terraced yard into the low, thatch-roofed hut. The acrid, larval smell inside didn't bother her. The silkworm cocoonery was my grandmother's own personal reeking oasis. All around her, in a firmament, soft white silkworms clung to bundled mulberry twigs. Desdemona watched them spinning cocoons, moving their heads as though to music. As she watched, she forgot about the world outside, its changes and convulsions, its terrible new music, which is about to be sung in a moment. Instead, she heard her mother, Ephrosyne Stephanides, speaking in this very cocoonery years ago, elucidating the mysteries of silkworms. "To have good silk, you have to be pure," she used to tell her daughter. "The silkworms know everything. You can always tell what somebody is up to by the way their silk looks." And so on. Ephrosyne giving examples. "Maria Poulos, who's always lifting her skirt for everyone. Have you seen her cocoons? A stain for every man. You should look next time." Desdemona, only 11 or 12, and believing every word, so that now, as a young woman of 21, she still couldn't entirely disbelieve her mother's morality tales and examine the cocoon constellations for a sign of her own impurity, the dreams she'd been having. She looked for other things, too, because her mother also maintained that silkworms reacted to historical atrocities. After every massacre, even in a village 50 miles away, the silkworm's filaments turned the color of blood.
"I've seen them bleed like the feet of Christos himself," Ephrosyne again.
And her daughter, years later, remembering, squinting in the weak light to see if any cocoons had turned red. She pulled out a tray and shook it. She pulled out another. And it was right then that she felt her heart stop, squeeze into a ball, and begin punching her from inside. She dropped the tray, saw her tunic flutter from interior force, and understood that her heart operated on its own instructions, that she had no control over it, or indeed over anything else. So my Yaya, suffering the first of her imaginary diseases, stood looking down at Bursa, as though she might spot a visible confirmation of her invisible dread. And then it came from inside the house, by means of sound. Her brother, Eleftherios Lefty Stephanides, had begun to sing. In badly pronounced, meaningless English, "Every morning, every evening, ain't we got fun? Lefty sang, standing before the bedroom mirror as he did every afternoon about this time, fastening the new celluloid collar to the new white shirt, squeezing a dollop of hair pomade, smelling of limes, into his palm and rubbing it into his new Valentino haircut, and continuing, "In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?" The lyrics meant nothing to him either, but the melody was enough. It spoke to Lefty of jazz age frivolity, gin cocktails, cigarette girls. It made him slick his hair back with panache. While out in the yard, Desdemona heard the singing and reacted differently. For her, the song conjured only the disreputable bars her brother went to down in the city. Those hash dens where they played Drabitica and American music and where there were loose women who sang. As Lefty put on his new striped suit and folded the red pocket handkerchief that matched his red necktie, and she felt funny inside, especially her stomach, which was roiled by complicated emotions, sadness, anger, and something else she couldn't name that hurt most of all. "The rent's unpaid, dear, we haven't a car," Lefty crooned in the sweet tenor I would later inherit. And beneath the music, Desdemona now heard her mother's voice again, Ephrosyne Stefanides' last words spoken just before she died from a bullet wound. "Take care of Lefty. Promise me. Find him a wife." And Desdemona, through her tears, replied, "I promise. I promise." These voices all speaking at once in Desdemona's head as she crossed the yard to go into the house. She came through the small kitchen, where she had dinner cooking for one, and marched straight into the bedroom she shared with her brother. He was still singing, "Not much money, oh, but honey," fixing his cufflinks, parting his hair, but then he looked up and saw his sister. "Ain't we got?" And pianissimo now, "Fun," fell silent. For a moment, the mirror held their two faces. At 21, long before ill-fitting dentures and self-imposed invalidism, my grandmother was something of a beauty. She wore her black hair in long braids pinned up under her kerchief. These braids were not delicate like a little girl's, but heavy and womanly, possessing a natural power like a beaver's tail. Years, seasons, and various weather had got into the braids, and when she undid them at night, they fell to her waist. At present, black silk ribbons were tied around the braids, too, making them even more imposing, if you got to see them, which few people did. What was on view for general consumption was Desdemona's face, her large, sorrowful eyes, her pale, candle-lit complexion. I should also mention, with the vestigial pang of a once flat-chested girl, Desdemona's voluptuous figure. Her body was a constant embarrassment to her. It was always announcing itself in ways she didn't sanction. In church, when she knelt. In the yard, when she beat rugs. Beneath the peach tree, when she picked fruit. Desdemona's feminine elaborations escaped the constraints of her drab, confining clothes. Beneath the jiggling of her body, her kerchief-framed face remained apart, looking slightly scandalized at what her breasts and hips were up to. Eleftherios was taller and skinnier. In photographs from the time, he looks like the underworld figures he idolized, the thin, mustachioed thieves and gamblers who filled the seaside bars of Athens and Constantinople. His nose was aquiline, his eyes sharp, the overall impression of his face hawk-like. When he smiled, however, you saw the softness in his eyes, which made it clear that Lefty was in fact no gangster, but the pampered, bookish son of comfortably well-off parents. That summer afternoon in 1922, Desdemona wasn't looking at her brother's face. Instead, her eyes moved to the suit coat, to the gleaming hair, to the striped trousers, as she tried to figure out what had happened to him these past few months. Lefty was 1 year younger than Desdemona, and she often wondered how she'd survived those first 12 months without him. For as long as she could remember, he'd always been on the other side of the goat's hair blanket that separated their beds. Behind the kulimi, he performed puppet shows, turning his hands into the clever hunchback Karayosis, who always outwitted the Turks. In the dark, he made up rhymes and sang songs, and one of the reasons she hated his new American music was that he sang it exclusively to himself. Desdemona had always loved her brother, as only a sister growing up on a mountain could love a brother. He was the whole entertainment, her best friend and confidant, her co-discoverer of shortcuts in monk cells. Early on, the emotional sympathy she'd felt with Lefty had been so absolute that she'd sometimes forgotten they were separate people. As kids, they'd scrabbled down the terraced mountainside like a four-legged, two-headed creature. She was accustomed to their Siamese shadows springing up against the whitewashed house at evening, and whenever she encountered her solitary outline, it seemed cut in half. Peacetime seemed to be changing everything. Lefty had taken advantage of the new freedoms. In the last month, he'd gone down to Bursa a total of 17 times. On 3 occasions, he'd stayed overnight in the Cocoon Inn across from the mosque of Sultan Ulhan. He'd left one morning dressed in boots, knee socks, breeches, thulamis, and vest, and come back the following evening in a striped suit with a silk scarf tucked into his collar like an opera singer and a black derby on his head. There were other changes. He'd begun to teach himself French from a small plum-colored phrase book. He'd picked up affected gestures, putting his hands in his pockets and rattling change, for instance, or doffing his cap. When Desdemona did the laundry, she found scraps of paper in Lefty's pockets covered with mathematical figures. His clothes smelled musky, smoky, and sometimes sweet. Now in the mirror, their joined faces couldn't hide the fact of their growing separation. And my grandmother, whose constitutional gloom had broken out into full cardiac thunder, looked at her brother, as she once had her own shadow, and felt that something was missing.
"So where are you going all dressed up?"
"Where do you think I'm going? To Kozahan, sell cocoons."
"You went yesterday."
"It's the season." With a tortoiseshell comb, Lefty parted his hair on the right, adding pomade to an unruly curl that refused to stay flat. Desdemona came closer. She picked up the pomade and sniffed it. It wasn't the smell on his clothes.
"What else do you do down there?"
"Nothing." "You stay all night sometimes."
"Well, it's a long trip. By the time I walk there, it's late."
"What are you smoking in those bars?"
"Whatever's in the hookah. It's not polite to ask."
"If Mother and Father knew you were smoking and drinking like this..." She trailed off.
"They don't know, do they?" said Lefty. "So I'm safe."
His light tone was unconvincing. Lefty acted as though he had recovered from their parents' deaths, but Desdemona saw through this. She smiled grimly at her brother and, without comment, held out her fist. Automatically, while still admiring himself in the mirror, Lefty made a fist too. They counted. 1, 2, 3. Shoot! "Rock crushes snake. I win," said Desdemona. "So tell me."
"Tell you what?"
"Tell me what's so interesting in Bursa." Lefty combed his hair forward again and parted it on the left. He swiveled his head back and forth in the mirror. "Which looks better, left or right? Let me see." Desdemona raised her hand delicately to Lefty's hair and mussed it.
"Hey!
What do you want in Bursa? Leave me alone. Tell me.
You want to know?"
Lefty said, exasperated with his sister now. "What do you think I want?" He spoke with pent-up force. "I want a woman." Desdemona gripped her belly, patted her heart. She took 2 steps backward and from this vantage point examined her brother anew. The idea that Lefty, who shared her eyes and eyebrows, who slept in the bed beside hers, could be possessed by such a desire had never occurred to Desdemona before. Though physically mature, Desdemona's body was still a stranger to its owner. At night, in their bedroom, she'd seen her sleeping brother press against his rope mattress as though angry with it. As a child, she'd come upon him in the cocoonery, innocently rubbing against a wooden post. But none of this had made an impression. "What are you doing?" she'd asked Lefty, 8 or 9 at the time, and gripping the post, moving his knees up and down. With a steady, determined voice, he'd answered,
"I'm trying to get that feeling."
"What feeling?" "You know, grunting, puffing, pumping knees. That feeling." But she didn't know. It was still years before Desdemona, cutting cucumbers, would lean against the corner of the kitchen table and, without realizing it, would lean in a little harder, and after that would find herself taking up that position every day, the table corner snug between her legs. Now, preparing her brother's meals, she sometimes struck up her old acquaintance with the dining table, but she wasn't conscious of it. It was her body that did it, with the cunning and silence of bodies everywhere. Her brother's trips to the city were different. He knew what he was looking for, apparently. He was in full communication with his body. His mind and body had become one entity, thinking one thought, bent on one obsession, and for the first time ever, Desdemona couldn't read that thought. All she knew was that it had nothing to do with her. It made her mad, also, I suspect, a little jealous. Wasn't she his best friend? Hadn't they always told each other